The Legislative Commission on Data Practices to order. We don't have a quorum quite yet, but I know some people are on their way. So we'll go ahead and get started. And the first order of business would be approval of the minutes from November 16th. Senator Limmer has moved the minutes. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor? Oh, I can't vote on it. We'll do that in a minute. The first order of business after the approval of the minutes is we have Chris Busey here with the deputy he's a deputy legislative auditor, and he's going to be addressing an issue that he brought to my attention a couple of weeks. So, Mr. Busey, if you want to go ahead and take to the testifiers table. And if you could state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Sure. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Christopher Busey. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Minnesota Office of Legislative Auditor. Madam Chair and committee members, I'm here this morning to express support for proposed changes to the Minnesota statute that governs data breaches for government entities. That's Minnesota Statute 13.055. And to start at the high level, I'm expressing my support for the proposed changes because I think it brings our government data breach statute in better alignment with generally accepted best practices that we find in industry. And to be a little bit more specific, there's an underlying principle that most organizations follow, and that's if you expose somebody's not public data, then you notify people that you actually expose their data. So that's the principle that most organizations follow. Our government, our statute 13055, does a fairly good job explaining how we do notification in state government. And that's not the issue today. What's the issue is how do we actually define what constitutes a security breach? Now, when you dig into the bowels of that statute, one of the things that you'll find is that in order for a breach to occur in the current law, there's really two underlying litmus tests. First of all, the unauthorized exposure of the data has to occur. I think everybody would recognize that. The second thing, though, is that the underlying exposure of data, the person who gets the data, has to have intent to use that data inappropriately. And it's that second piece of the law that really becomes problematic. Now, before joining the Legislative Auditor's Office, I had the opportunity of working on lots of different security incidents, and one of the things that I can say from that experience is the vast majority of security incidents that happen that lead to exposures of data are due to accidents that take place and employee errors. And one of the things that you find with those accidents or employee errors that lead to the unauthorized exposure of data is rarely are those situations where the people that get access to data because of those accidents or errors, rarely do those people intend to do something bad with that data. So following the logic of the law today, you could argue that any time an accident or an error occurs that leads to the exposure of data, that it could be construed as not being a breach under Minnesota law because of the second litmus test that's in the law today.
Thank you.
To give you an example, there's issues where we have IT systems where errors are made, where data is exposed because of IT changes that are made to the IT systems. But there's also simple things that happen on the business side as well. One example that comes to mind that I dealt with during my career was we had an employee who mailed out a spreadsheet that had not public data in it it was against policy, but when you mail out a spreadsheet with not public data to inappropriate people, one of the things that you can argue is that, well, the people that got the data didn't intend to use it for inappropriate purposes, so therefore it's not a breach. So that's just a quick example of how this law could be misconstrued today. So I do support the changes because it brings the law into an alignment, and it will get Minnesota into a position where we just follow a simple rule of thumb that if not public data is exposed, then people whose data was exposed are actually notified. It takes out that convoluted part of the statute that deals with trying to determine whether there was intent for something bad to happen.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being here. Any member questions on this particular issue? Senator Limmer? At the end of our meeting today, I would like to make a recommendation that we recommend to the full legislature that we adopt this language, and at that time we'll be taking some public testimony to see where people are at with this. I think there may be some people in the audience today that would like to testify on it, but I would like to withhold, wait for public testimony till the end of the meeting today. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. I'm saying it wrong. I've been saying Busey all these years, and it's Busey, like 00.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Yes. All right. Thank you so much. Yes. So we do have a quorum now, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we'll go ahead and approve those minutes. Any discussion?
I'll renew my motion.
Senator Limmer renews his motion that we approve the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. We do have a few minutes before. Well, maybe the thing to do here would be to hear from Mr. Pitts while we're waiting for at 10 o'clock. Kathy Hibbs from 23andMe is going to be calling in. So, Mr. Pitts, do you have... do you think you can squeeze your testimony in 15 minutes?
Sure.
Perfect. We appreciate you being here this morning. And just a little background for members of the commission. I found Mr. Pitts from a couple of articles that I read on these genealogy, direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies. And so I reached out to him, and he was kind enough to make the trip from the East Coast. And I think he has some Minnesota connections from the past, but we really appreciate you being here. If you would introduce yourself for the tape, that would be appreciated. Then you can go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Peter Pitts. I'm the president of a not-for-profit think tank, a public policy institute called the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest, and I'm a former associate commissioner at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Your DNA is the most valuable thing that you own. It is you. If you're concerned about online phishing of your Social Security number, purloined DNA is identity theft on the most intimate level possible. Genetic testing promises a revolution in healthcare. With just a few swabs of saliva, diagnostics can provide an unprecedented look into a person's family history and potential health risks. Within a decade, global sales of genetic tests are expected to hit $10 billion. That's billion with a B. Direct-to-consumer genetic companies such as 23andMe and Ancestry.com have proven particularly popular. About 12 million Americans have bought these tests in recent years. And with the holiday shopping season upon us, millions of Americans have found the great new stocking stuffer of DNA genetic tests. And it's easy to see why these companies from Ancestry.com to DNA, Ancestry DNA to MyHeritage are so popular. For less than $100, folks can discover their ancestry and uncover potentially dangerous genetic mutations. One firm, Vinome, even recommends wines based on DNA test results. You can look it up. But the industry's rapid growth rests on a dangerous delusion that genetic data is kept private. Most people assume this sensitive information simply sits in a secure database protected from hacks and misuse. Far from it. Genetic testing companies cannot guarantee privacy, and many are actively selling user data to multiple outside parties. The problem starts with the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, a 1996 federal law that allows medical companies to share and sell patient data if it has been anonymized or scrubbed of any obvious identifying characteristics. The Portability Act was passed when genetic testing was just a distant dream on the horizon of personalized medicine. But today, that loophole has proven to be a cash cow. For instance, 23andMe has sold access to its database to at least 13 outside pharmaceutical firms. One buyer, Genentech, ponied up a cool $10 million for the genetic profiles of people suffering from Parkinson's disease. Ancestry DNA, another popular personal genetics company, recently announced a lucrative data-sharing partnership with the biotech company Calico. Customers are wrong to think their information is safely locked away. It's not. It's getting sold far and wide. Many testing firms that generally don't sell patient information, such as Ambry and Invitae, give it away to public databases. Such transfers leave a big gap in privacy protections. Hacks are inevitable. Easy, accessible public genetic depositories are obvious targets. If genetic tests do fall into the hands of nefarious actors, it's relatively easy for them to de-anonymize it. New lab techniques can unearth genetic markers tied to specific physical traits, such as eye or hair color, and sleuths can then cross-reference those traits against publicly available demographic data to identify the donors. While this is a potential forensic goldmine for police and public safety officials, as we recently witnessed in the capture of the Golden State Killer, the risks of abuse are equally as great. One MIT scientist was able to identify the people behind five supposedly anonymous genetic samples randomly selected from a public research database. It took him less than a day. Likewise, a Harvard Medical School professor dug up the identities of over 80% of the samples housed in his school's genetic database. Privacy protections can be broken. Indeed, Linda Avey, a co-founder of 23andMe, has explicitly admitted that, quote, "It's a fallacy to think that genomic data can be fully anonymized." Once genetic data has been linked to a specific person, the potential for abuse is vast and frightening. Imagine a political campaign exposing a rival's elevated risk of Alzheimer's disease, or an employer refusing to hire someone because autism runs in her family. Imagine a world where people can have their genomic building blocks held against them. Such abuses represent a profound violation of privacy. It's an inherent risk in current genetic testing practices. For their part, direct-to-consumer testing companies have been less than forthright about these dangers, usually burying privacy disclaimers deep in their contracts and refusing to disclose how long they keep customer data or how it can be used. New research published in the journal Nature found that genetic testing companies frequently fail to meet even basic international transparency standards. Consider Ancestry DNA's agreement. It grants the company, quote, "a sublicensable, worldwide, royalty-free license to host, store, copy, publish, distribute, provide access to, create derivative works of, and otherwise use such user-provided content, your genetic information." In other words, Ancestry DNA all but owns the data that its customers submit. 23andMe customers have to wade through pages of fine print before finding out that their information may be, quote, "shared with research partners, including commercial partners." Meanwhile, Invitae's privacy policy reveals that it may use patients' de-identified data for research and development or general research purposes, and the company can share that data with third parties such as public databases, other laboratories, and universities. Genetic testing has tremendous benefits. We are provided a closer look at our own biology. Medical researchers develop a deeper understanding of the origins of disease and create powerful new treatments through precision medicine. But today, far too many donors are operating under a false sense of security, handling profoundly intimate data without appropriate protections. DNA testing kits aren't just fun cocktail party conversation pieces or Yuletide tokens. And now, Uncle Sam wants you, or at least your DNA. That's the takeaway from the new All of Us research program at the National Institutes of Health. The initiative claims to collect electronic health records and DNA samples from at least 1 million Americans. Any person 18 or older is eligible to participate. Researchers hope that the donated data will help them better understand diseases and develop more personalized treatments. This new effort is well-intentioned, but the privacy protections in the NIH's All of Us project are weak. The NIH says it will store donors' data in a scientific database containing individual-level data and samples, which may be accessed by researchers anywhere in the world, including those working for private companies. Information stored in a federal database might seem relatively secure, but it's not. Back in 2015, for example, the U.S. Office of Personnel Management discovered that hackers had stolen highly sensitive information of more than 21 million Americans, including fingerprint records. Or consider the data breaches at the Department of Veterans Affairs. In 2014, the VA's Office of Information and Technology Risk Management warned that a data breach to employees and veterans' financial, medical, and personal information was practically unavoidable. Despite the warnings, the VA experienced a 36% increase in data breaches of personal health information between October 2015 and November 2015. Facts, as John Adams reminds us, are pesky things. In short, when Americans voluntarily submit their DNA for analysis, there's just no telling who will have access to it or whether that information will one day become public. And unlike a credit card number or an email password, which consumers can change if a security breach occurs, a person's genetic code is permanent. The NIH and private for-profit companies present genetic testing as a harmless activity that promises personal discovery and medical progress. But sharing one's DNA will always come with serious risks, particularly to one's privacy. In an era where data breaches are increasingly common, Americans ought to think twice before sharing their genes with strangers, whether or not those strangers have a commercial imperative. In conclusion, there are five key reasons Americans should think twice before buying a DNA testing kit. One, the results are often inaccurate. Testing kits are good at unveiling people's ethnic lineage. However, the results are notoriously unreliable at determining whether someone has a dangerous genetic mutation. According to a study published in Genetics and Medicine, up to 40% of variants in a variety of genes reported in testing kit raw data were false positives. In plain English, that means testing companies often mistook a harmless genetic mutation for a dangerous one. Such false alarms could cause patients significant stress and force them to undergo expensive, unnecessary testing or procedures. Shirley Wu, a director at 23andMe, has explicitly admitted that, quote, its raw data are not for medical or diagnostic use, close quote. Two, commercial DNA databases are vulnerable to hacks. Earlier this year, MyHeritage reported that hackers stole email addresses of 92 million users. Thankfully, patients' genetic information wasn't compromised this time. But as consumer genetic testing becomes more popular, there's little doubt that criminals will continue trying to infiltrate testing companies' servers. Three, your genetic information could be sold to the highest bidder. Many direct-to-consumer testing companies have signed lucrative data-sharing agreements with pharmaceutical companies. 23andMe has a $300 million deal with GlaxoSmithKline. And the biggest buyer of ancestry data is a biotech company bankrolled by Silicon Valley billionaires. Users do have to sign consent forms before companies can sell their DNA to third parties, but the user agreements are so opaque that most people have no clue what they're agreeing to. Four, your genetic information is not anonymous. Testing companies anonymize genetic data before sharing it with outside companies or researchers, but that process can be reversed. It's possible to identify unique mutations in an anonymous sample of DNA and compare those quirks to public databases to identify the donor. Using this technique, MIT scientists identified the donors behind five samples in one day. Five, your genetic data can be used against you. Federal genetic privacy laws do not apply to life, long-term care, or disability insurers. These companies are legally permitted to access genetic testing data and charge people higher prices or deny coverage based on their findings. According to Ellen Wright Clayton, a lawyer and Vanderbilt professor, existing law, quote, actually provides very little protection, close quote, against this sort of discrimination. Direct-to-consumer genetic testing kits might seem like the perfect holiday gift, but these tests risk people's privacy while offering scant medical benefits. What you risk reveals what you value. In the 21st century, we must learn to value our personal genetic code. caveat venditor. Let the seller beware. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pitts. And if you could be on standby here, what time does your plane leave?
Not till 3. I'm
okay,
fine.
Good. I know that we have Ms. Hibbs. Is that you on the phone?
Yes, I just joined.
Okay, thank you. Since you're here by phone, we'll go ahead and hear from you, and then Mr. Pitts be on standby, and I'm sure we'll have some good questions to look forward to asking. Ms. Pitts, I don't know if you prepared any specific opening remarks or testimony, or did you just want the commission to ask you questions? What were your thoughts?
I did prepare some opening remarks that I'd be happy to provide.
Okay. Well, please go ahead then. If you want to introduce yourself for our tape, that would be great. Thank you.
Certainly. Good morning, honorable members of the Minnesota House of Representatives and distinguished guests. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today, and thank you for the invitation. I'm Kathy Hibbs. I am the Chief Legal and Regulatory Officer for 23andMe, and I'm happy to provide information on the DTC genetics landscape, our services, and our privacy and security practices. For background, 23andMe was founded in 2006 by our co-founder, Ann Wojcicki. We have approximately 600 employees and are headquartered in Mountain View, California. All of our testing is conducted in the U.S., and 23andMe is the only direct-to-consumer company authorized by the FDA to provide health information directly to consumers, having demonstrated to FDA's requirements on numerous occasions in pre-market submissions that our product is safe and effective for use without prescription. 23andMe's consumer genetic testing kit is available online and in stores at various retailers. We offer two products, an ancestry test and a Health Plus ancestry test. That later test includes FDA-authorized health reports on genetic risk, carrier status, wellness, and traits, along with the genetic ancestry reports. To date, 23andMe is the only provider in the U.S. to have FDA authorization for over-the-counter genetic testing. In granting authorization to us for over-the-counter use, as with other drugs and medical devices which have been authorized for sale without prescription, the FDA reviewed extensive analytical and clinical data demonstrating the robust accuracy of our product and also required 23andMe to conduct and submit numerous studies demonstrating that the average U.S. consumer, regardless of age, education, gender, or ethnicity, can understand our product, its uses, and its limitations. There is an important distinction between our highly regulated FDA-authorized tests and other genetic tests on the market offering health information to consumers through a veiled physician model. Those tests have not been reviewed by FDA or any other regulatory body and are not authorized by FDA to be sold without prescription directly to consumers. In fact, although marketed directly to consumers, those tests are for physician use only and therefore require a prescription. These laboratory tests, developed tests, or LDTs as they were referred to in your background model, are currently under FDA's, quote, enforcement discretion. However, it is so long as they do not sell genetic health information direct to consumer. However, in many instances, these laboratories are selling online prescriptions to consumers with their tests in order to circumvent FDA requirements, with varying levels of disclosure to the consumer on the prescription nature of their products and or the financial relationships between the lab and the prescribers. In particular, see the portion of the FDA's website, which we cited to you in written response. As a matter of policy, the FDA generally does not review some types of tests called laboratory-developed tests that are created and performed in a single laboratory if they are offered to patients only when prescribed by a healthcare provider. These tests typically do not have FDA's independent assurance of analytical, clinical, or communication or clear communication of test results. Unlike 23andMe's products, the safety and efficacy of these LDTs are undemonstrated. Beyond our core consumer genetic testing policy, our mission is and has always been to research and empower and improve the lives of consumers and others through genetics-based discovery. The company conducts research internally and on behalf of third-party collaborators. We also have our own in-house therapeutics group that utilizes information from consented research participants to find treatments for unmet medical needs, such as Parkinson's disease and different types of cancer. We have discovered and collaborated on nearly 120 peer-reviewed publications in the space. Importantly, all of our research is conducted solely with information from consented research participants, which is overseen by an outside independent third party known as an Institutional Review Board, or IRB, the gold standard for ethics insight oversight when conducting human subject research. All of our research is completely voluntary. Customers have the choice to opt into research via a research consent document approved by IRB. This consent is separate from our terms and service and not required to be a 23andMe customer. The consent allows 23andMe to study the data in-house and in collaboration with third parties and only through a de-identification process. Again, only consented customer data is used for any type of research, and no one is opted in to research. As to the de-identification, meaning it is stripped of personally identifiable information and studied in the aggregate, among many others, de-identified information. For research done in collaboration with any third party, 23andMe conducts the research internally and shares an aggregate de-identified analysis of that research with the third party. For example, summary information, which may include a statement like 30% of males aged 35 to 50 have reported being diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and have certain genetic variants, without providing any data or testing results specific to any individual. Customers do have the option to give a separate consent to share de-identified individual-level data with collaborators should they choose. I do want to speak directly to the insurance issue that Mr. Pitts raised as well at the end of his remarks. It's important to recognize that, in fact, the GINA law does not prevent discrimination in the area of life insurance, disability, or long-term care insurance. However, it's also important to recognize that in issuing any of those policies currently, the insurance industry asks extensive questionnaires of the individuals applying for insurance and very frequently also does tests such as blood or cholesterol tests to determine the state of health of the individual at the time of the policy they are seeking and their family health history. So the genetic information, we do not provide genetic information to insurance companies, nor are we aware of any insurance company requiring or attempting to get genetic information. It is important to note that they, as a common requirement of any of those policies, require extensive information in sworn applications by anyone who is applying for it. So it's unrealistic to suggest that genetic information is somehow the only basis on which insurance companies would use for actuarial information in giving or pricing any policy of that nature. And with that, I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Hibbs. Are there any member questions for the online testifier? I have a couple. How long does your company retain a customer's genetic information? Or sample?
So we retain a customer's genetic information if they have consented to research for the period during which they have consented to research. If at any time, and it is an easy online process in their account, it'll tell you if you are a customer, it says you are currently consented to research. You can click to unconsent to research at any time. And if you do, we will remove your data within 30 days. Of you having done that. And, of course, for our consumers who don't consent to research and don't want to be part of the research aspects of our mission, their data or sample is never used for that. We are required, the laboratory requirements under CLIA and CAP do require the laboratory and us to maintain one copy of the data for a period of 10 years. Or at least just to prove that the testing met the requirements under which it was provided.
And do you know, because you have this FDA approval that other companies do not, Do those other companies, to your knowledge, and I know I'm asking you probably out of your sphere of what you may know or be willing to offer, do they also keep the information for 10 years? Or if a customer doesn't consent to having it shared with anyone, with some of these other companies, is it destroyed, or do you happen to know?
I don't know. We are members of an industry group called the Frontiers of Privacy, Future of Privacy Forum, and there are industry standards that have been agreed to with regards to consent and storage of information and the like by the members of that group, of which we are one, and others are as well. And those privacy policies that are voluntary, but those are quite well described, and I think in our materials we sent you information on that. I hope you did receive the information that we sent. I know it was late last night in terms of your time, but
okay.
I would point you to looking at those policies and then looking to see which companies are members of that. One thing of note, because we are under the FDA and we have met all of their requirements, the FDA for any medical device manufacturer, including ourselves, has what are called the cybersecurity guidance documents, and we do comply with that, and there aren't other companies who would meet the FDA's cybersecurity requirements because they have not gone through that process.
Okay. And what is your process if, first of all, have you ever had a breach, a data breach? And secondly, what is your protocol for notifying customers if there is a breach?
Okay. We have never had a data breach. We do keep a personally identifying information, such as your name or email or credit card information or address or anything like that, separate from your genetic information. It works similar to the way that online banking works, meaning those two pieces of information are only ever combined when a user signs into their account and supplies their password information, and then they're digitally merged. So there are a number of security steps that are taken to protect the information so that it will not leak and has not leaked. We do maintain a transparency report on our website, which we update frequently. That largely discloses requests that we have had from any criminal agency seeking information. We have never provided any information to law enforcement, nor have we ever gotten even to the level that there was a subpoena. As to in the event of a breach, we do have an internal group that is on constant standby for IT security as well as privacy, which would escalate any such issue, investigate it, and then we would notify any customer that was affected were it to happen. We're obviously prepared for that. We work very hard to make sure it does not happen, but you know, we recognize the possibility of it occurring, and therefore we do have prepared lines of communication and escalation and then reporting to affected consumers were it to happen.
Well, I will say this about 23andMe. I've done some looking online and compared you to Ancestry.com, and it seems like your disclosures and that sort of thing are easily found compared to trying to navigate Ancestry.com. That is it's almost not hidden, but it's really hard to find. There isn't even an option to click on their homepage, you know, to read any of their policies on disclosure and research and consent and those sorts of things. Has your company ever been sued by a dissatisfied customer? And if so, if someone is dissatisfied and wants to bring legal action, what does that look like with your company?
Well, we have not had individual customer lawsuits, which is a good thing. We did, as you may be aware, in 2013 receive a warning letter from the FDA, and as a result of that, we did have class action lawsuits that were brought that have long since been resolved, but we have not had any individual litigation with any consumers. We do have a very robust consumer or customer care organization that answers literally hundreds of thousands of customer inquiries and questions every year, the majority of which are the things I think everyone would expect, which are, I've lost my password, or how do I print something? But obviously there are certain questions that are serious, and we have an escalation process. Again, because we are an FDA manufacturer, we do have a post-market quality system that requires us to do that. And similarly, outside of the U.S., we also have post-market quality requirements. So any complaint that is with regards to a failure of the product, and that would include a privacy failure of the product as well as a misunderstanding of the product or any dissatisfaction, actually gets escalated to the members of that team, which include not only folks from both my legal and regulatory groups, but folks from our operations and quality groups as well as from our medical affairs and communications groups. So we work very hard to resolve any customer questions. And I just want to note, I think it might be interesting for you to know that our privacy pages, we're very proud of them. We do put quite a bit of work into making them understandable and transparent and easy for people to find. And in fact, our privacy pages are the third most visited section of our website, which is something that we really strive for. We really do want people to have access to that information when they're making their buying decisions. And of course, again, because of our FDA requirements on the health side, you know, we have certain things that we must include in our pre-purchase information, and that does include information on privacy and information about the what you can learn from genetics and important considerations. Some of our results can be extremely impactful. For example, our BRCA1, BRCA2 selected variants result, that genetic mutation is associated with a very high instance of ovarian, breast, and prostate cancer in men, but we want people to understand before they buy our product, and then there is even a further opt-in before they opt in to see their results, even if they bought the product. And we include information about the fact that your family members, if we're talking about a genetic trait that you have or a genetic risk that you have, our genes are all inherited. That means that the information that you're about to understand is shared by your other family members. And not everyone in your family may want to know that information. So there is quite a bit of extensive information on that, as well as information about the possibility of discrimination in employment or in the areas of insurance that we previously touched on.
So, In answer to the question about if someone wanted to sue you, do they have to go to California? Do they have to go to arbitration? What would be the process?
We do have an arbitration provision in our terms of service. They would not have to come to California to do that, but we do have an arbitration provision.
All right, thank you. Senator Limmer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hibbs, you made mention of an association, I'm assuming it's a corporate association called the Frontiers of Privacy Forum.
Privacy Forum?
Oh, the Future of Privacy Forum?
Yes.
All right. Do you have a website for that organization?
SPS.org.
SPS, like Sam, Peggy Sam?
Sorry, Frank PaulFred.org.
All right. Thank you. And you also made mention of references to words that I'm not familiar in your testimony, CLIA and CAP. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
What do those mean?
Sure. So CMS, the Centers for Medicare, has requirements for laboratories having to do with their personnel and their laboratory assists and their laboratory operations. They don't do any pre-market review of any test or any review of any test post-market either. But there are requirements, federal requirements, on laboratories for the personnel that they hire and what they can do. And that is what the CLIA Act is about. It is, I don't even know if at this point in time I can remember what exactly the acronym stands for. The Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act, I think of 1988, is what CLIA is. And again, it's the licensure requirement for laboratories in the U.S. CAP is the College of American Pathologists. That's a voluntary accreditation that some labs have, including the laboratory that we use to do our wet lab steps. So the College of American Pathologists, again, is voluntary. There isn't a pre-market requirement, but they will issue, as other medical organizations do, they issue specialization notifications and things of that nature if you want to have a lab that has certain specialties.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
When this is Representative Scott again, when you sell customers' information, their DNA, even when you say it's, you know, anonymized, which I don't think that it truly can be from what we're learning, but when you sell that, do you have any in the contracts that you draw up with these people that you're selling it to? Is there anything in there that says you have to follow these specific privacy guidelines, much like what we have? So when you are when that DNA goes to a third party from your company, what protections are there going forward from that?
Sure. First of all, I do want to address a little bit the selling of data. We don't sell individual customer data, and frankly, there isn't a market for it. We do take steps to de-identify. Obviously, this is genetic information, so it's fundamentally identifiable, and we understand that. But there are a number of steps that we take to still protect information. Meaning that if there is a genetic signature that's extremely rare, say only a handful of people, less than 20 in our database have it, we will not reveal to a researcher or anyone else how many people actually have that information. Because that, if you narrow the filter, that obviously indicates ways that you could try to identify people. To your specific question, all of our research collaborations, including all of the ones that are done for free with academic institutions and other public interest institutions, require the collaborators to meet our same rigorous security standards and include robust technical and organizational controls. We've implemented a privacy and security diligence and contracting process with those research partners that includes audits and reports on their security measures throughout our collaboration.
Okay. I don't know how you can say that you don't sell the information. I know that you just reached a $300 million agreement with GlaxoSmithKline for research, and they would have no research if not for you providing it for them. Am I right?
I understand the point of your question, but I think that what you're missing is really what the interest is in terms of the researchers. Our genetic information, and I mean us as human beings, not our customers in this context, is not in itself necessarily interesting. What we do that makes the genetic information interesting is that we do a series of surveys with our consented customers if they choose to participate, and many of them do. We have the majority of our customers both consent and then participate. But they answer a number of questions about their health or their traits or all of these different things. And it is that information, which is called phenotypic data, in combination with broad genetic information that is actually interesting to our collaborators, be they academics or be they parties like GlaxoSmithKline. They're not interested in, you know, my individual genetic information. They're interested in looking for signatures, if you will, of disease or things that protect or prevent disease across broad populations. So our individual genetic information is not, that's kind of uninteresting data by itself without that other information, and then without the combined statistical power of other people, either with the same phenotypic signature, say migraines, for example, that's an area we've worked in, or fertility, or, you know, if you have a somewhat unique genetic signature, we first have to figure out, does that mean anything? It may mean nothing. You know, we're 98% similar with other primates, and we ourselves as individuals are basically 99.9% similar. So it is not just interesting broadly. And one thing I would point the committee to is the NIH's All of Us cohort, which was frankly based on 23andMe and has privacy and consent policies that were intentionally based on ours, that is looking to do the same thing on the behalf of the federal government and the NIH. And it is the same issue. It is basically a broad genetic testing then brought together with information about those individuals to see which genetic signatures are interesting, as opposed to the selling of 500 customers' data or something like that. So that's the point I'm trying to make. We've never been offered, nor would we take the money, but I don't think anybody has ever bought just raw genetic data for a research purpose.
All right. Senator Claussen, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Hibbs, thank you for being with us today.
Sure.
I have a question about your customer agreement. How long is that actually in effect? And how long is that data being kept if the customer would contact you and say, I no longer want to be a part of this? I'd like to relinquish my relationship, and I'd like to have any data you have removed and destroyed.
Ms. Hibbs.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, I answered that earlier, I believe. If a customer does not consent to research, their data is never stored by us for any purpose other than the provision of their account. If somebody wants to then close their account, they close their account. And if they want to at that point in time also assume somebody has consented to research, but then wants to unconsent to research and wants to close their account, they would notify us of that. They would close their account immediately. Our agreement says within 30 days we'll destroy any copies of their data, save the one copy that CLIA and CAP require the laboratory to maintain, which again is raw data. It's not their reports that are maintained. So it's not any account information. It's just the raw data, the raw genotypic data in their account. And that's how we handle that.
Senator Claussen?
Yes, Ms. Hibbs, thank you very much for that clarification. I was
sure.
A little bit unclear about that, so thank you.
One final question from me, Ms. Hibbs. What kind of internal auditing do you do to assure that the information from customers that you have is protected from, you know, maybe wondering eyes of employees and those sorts of things?
Sure. We have a number of internal processes that limit who can access what data, and we do strictly review that, again, because we are FDA. We have what's called QSR, or Quality Systems Regulations, under the Federal Rule 820, which FDA also audits us to. And we sell in the EU, so we are under the ISO requirements as well from a federal standpoint. FDA can inspect us at any time. Our European auditors and inspectors can also come in and do come in. And then all of our, many of our external collaborators, such as pharma companies, because they're also very concerned about this, can inspect us. But we do have internal auditing that goes on. We audit ourselves under our SOPs and the like. And we test on a pretty constant basis. We also train our employees and have our employees certify that they understand the privacy protections and all of the other things. For example, you know, there's lots of things that we do just from a data security standpoint to prevent hacking or any kind of data leakage through, you know, poor employee practices. as well. So we take many, many steps to do that, and we do constantly check ourselves with regards to that. That's why we do have, as I referred to earlier, basically an IT security and privacy team that meets frequently to assess any threats and to make sure that we're being appropriately vigilant. We recognize, obviously, that this data is important. It's important to our consumers, and there could be bad actors that would attempt to get the information. So we take that extremely seriously.
Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Ms. Hibbs, it's been said that in general, I'm talking generally in regarding this industry, that the DNA results can be inaccurate, or in the cases of recognizing genetic flaws, that reference might be unreliable. What is your opinion of the industry? Is that true?
Ms. Hibbs?
Well, it's clearly not true of us. I think in the materials, and I do apologize because I know we sent you a lot of information and it's late, but among what I included were FDA's own decision summaries of their pre-market review of our health results. And in order to meet FDA standards, we had to demonstrate that our test was at least 99% accurate. And actually what you'll see if you read those decision summaries is thousands of points of data that indicate that our results are closer to 100% accurate. Nothing is ever perfect, and I wouldn't want an FDA claim that said our test was perfect because I think that that would not be appropriate. But because this is an over-the-counter test, we've had to prove repeatedly and through tens of thousands of tests that we are at least 99% accurate, and that is with regards to both what's called PPV, or positive predictive value, as well as NPV, negative predictive value, and that result is reproducible, meaning that if you happen to get, you ordered a test from us on Tuesday and somebody else ordered a test from us the following Thursday, that both of those results would be equally 99% accurate. And we have had to meet robust clinical requirements through the FDA so that the genetic information that we provide to people as it relates to those health results is also clinically valid. Meaning if we tell you that you carry the BRCA variant, that the chance that that result is incorrect is very, very small. And importantly, the chance that the information we're telling you to go discuss with your own physician is not something the average physician would either understand or think was actionable, is also really, really small. So I can't speak to the validity of others, and this is something that we do worry about because that loophole that I alluded to in my opening remarks with regards to the fact that there are others who are selling unvalidated products and selling them to consumers as though they are appropriate for consumer use when what they're really selling is a prescription product, and they are frequently purchasing that prescription for these consumers with little or no information about those consumers. Those tests, I don't know what their analytical or clinical validity is, and no one does, because they are using that loophole to not have to submit their data to the FDA in the way that we have submitted our data to the FDA so that there can be a transparent understanding of how robust our test is, and also a recognition, which is really important, of the limitations of our test. No genetic test can rule out health risk for individuals. It's very important that people understand that. And genetics is an evolving field of science. There have been things, for example, in the cystic fibrosis gene. If someone was tested as a carrier for cystic fibrosis 20 years ago, there are some genes that we now know aren't associated with risk of cystic fibrosis that they would have been told at the time were, because that's what the understanding was, that's what the scientific and clinical understanding was. That has changed. It will change. It may change a little bit less going forward, but that's hard to say. And so that is something that I think it is really important that consumers be offered a product that where they can understand the validity of the information, both analytically and clinically. And we think that, frankly, having products out there that might not meet the same level of validation and might not have the same care associated with them just brings down the whole industry. We would greatly appreciate a spotlight on that because that's not our goal is really to be a leader in this space and to do this right. So we're not helped by competitors who bring those standards down.
Ms. Hibbs, Mr. Pitts testified, probably you didn't hear this before you were on the line there, but and I've heard this this report as well, that some folks at MIT were able to take some so-called anonymized or de-identified genetic information and within one day identify five different subjects from which they had the information. How is that done?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that was with regards to any 23andMe or even our competitor data. What that was, and this is a reason that we have the agreements that we have with academics not to do that. The people that I'm aware of who have ever been identified have been identified from small clinical trials. And we're identified by academic researchers where what happens is, say you have a family that has a unique disease and you have, say, three siblings in that family. And then those three individuals throughout the course of their treatment while working on clinical trials, which obviously many families that have a rare disease in their family will it be the subject of clinical trials. Those same patients end up in multiple clinical trials. And if each clinical trial says a little bit of something, it says, well, there are three siblings, and they live in the Northeast. That's how those individuals were actually identified. So it wasn't from our information or similar information. It was from piecing together information in published academic papers from clinical trial subjects where they were enrolled in these small clinical trials.
All right.
And it is certainly possible to do it. It's obviously unethical to do it as well. But that is the those are the situations that I suspect he was referring to.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony and for being with us online. And it was very informative.
Right. I appreciate the opportunity. And as I say, we did send materials late last night. So if you have follow-up questions after you've reviewed those, please reach out, and we'll be happy to respond.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Are there committee or commission questions for Mr. Pitts, who gave prior testimony? Please come forward, and if there's anything that you want to add after hearing that, I know some of the information seemed to be a little bit contradictory, but our primary focus here is the privacy provisions and the protection of that information and making sure that customers know what they're getting themselves into.
Sure. I mean, there would one thing I would. I mean, it's a great conversation, but one thing I would add specifically: she, woman from 23andMe, spoke specifically about patients in clinical trials, and I would add that to my list of frustrations. Is the last thing we want to do. It scare people away from wanting to participate in clinical trials. And if they feel more naked, more exposed because of the possibility of having their family histories exposed, add that to my list of things to worry about.
Okay. Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a follow-up to a question that I asked Ms. Hibbs. When you release that information, you signed an agreement. Is it realistic to think you can actually withdraw that at some point, given the various uses that the company may be using your DNA?
Mr. Pitts?
I wouldn't think so. And I think the one thing that Ms. Hibbs said that kind of struck a note with me is that when a consumer asks that their information be deleted from the database, it is. Obviously, one is kept for CLIA purposes, which is appropriate. But what remains is the ability of the customer, of the consumer, to access that data through their own password account. And I can only speak from personal experience. I expect that you probably have the same experience as, I don't know, what the heck most of my passwords are. And I write them on the back of envelopes, and I put them on a Word document, and I send them to people sometimes by mistake. So the fact that relationship even though it isn't under the control of the company, exists, I think is probably the leakiest part of that privacy issue. But yes, I do believe that if a company says they're going to get rid of the data, that they do get rid of the data. But there are lots of buts. But for the CLIA document, but for your own personal account. I think they're doing what they promised to do. But that might not be a complete answer to your question.
Senator Claussen?
Thank you.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you. Mr. Pitts, a lot of times people kind of think that a privacy agreement is a protection. And in this industry, the genetic testing industry, is there any requirements that these companies provide a privacy agreement or terms of use that a consumer could? First, is it universal, number one, and number two, is it written in a form that the average citizen could understand?
Well, let me take your last question first. No. I mean, rarely are any types of official, you know, heavily lawyered privacy documents written, you know, at a level that most people that aren't attorneys can understand. That's certainly my experience, and I'm a college graduate. You know, and I think that the problem is we all see that all the time, and therefore don't even make an attempt to read it. You know, for example, when you go in, Ms. Sims talked about CLIA labs. So, for an example of a CLIA certification would be, your doctor says, "I want you to give some blood. We want to do some blood tests." That facility is regulated under the CLIA. When you go in and you sign those documents, you're signing some very potent privacy protections. And the most important one is you're giving that lab the permission to share your blood work with your physician. Mm-hmm. How is it shared? How secure is the email? How secure is the security mechanism of your doctor's office? I mean, I suspect that 23andMe's security IT is far superior to my single practitioner's email account on Gmail. But it's happening all the time. There's lots of data flowing around, and I think the bigger the business, the more heavily lawyered the privacy protection documents are. And it also, it isn't always protection for you, the individual, so much as it is a protection for the company that's collecting the data.
One question that I keep coming up with is the lack of standards when it comes to privacy agreements and the understandability. We've all become very dependent on our cell phones, and if anyone reads the privacy agreement that, let's say, a major company would have, it can range from anywhere from 5 to 30 pages of very fine print that you see on a tiny little screen here. And most people, due to the fact that they have an ultimate dependence on this type of technology, they'll literally sign anything in order to get the use of that cell phone. And it's becoming more and more common. It's the same thing that we're going to discuss later, and that's consent forms on medical data when you go to a doctor's office or you need an emergency medical treatment. You'll literally sign anything that's in front of you without reading it. And so that kind of raises a lot of concern for me in order to protect the consumer. I'm familiar with Gmail and Google, and somewhere deep into that contract, it'll inform the consumer that they're going to not only record all of that information that you're tapping into your computer, but they will sell it to whoever wants it. And most consumers don't even know that. In general, now I think the public is generally accepting, well, if I'm going to use that technology, I guess I just have to put up with that. And that's kind of a sad point in our history when a product becomes such a factor in our lives that it's an ultimate dependence. We can't be competitive in our business without it. That becomes now a much more different product because it's so essential to modern life. And it's not the it's not like it was 20 years ago where you kind of had an option that you could walk away from the technology and still be able to function adequately in a modern society, but now you can't. And this is this genetic testing industry seems like it's just a curious oddity that people can find out a little more detail about their background or maybe confirm some suspicions of what their grandmother said was related to her. But it can turn into something much, much more if there aren't parameters of mm-hmm. play on it. And I'm glad you're raising questions about it. And I'm glad we're having discussion about it, because sometimes these things that are so common to our modern society, we don't ask anymore. And it's important. I have another question.
Well, first, let me say, I agree.
Yeah.
You know,
unrelated to this is just the little OnStar radio thing that's on your modern cars these days. I don't think there's any restriction on the data on that. And that can be sold to anybody, I'm assuming, because I don't think I've signed anything, and I don't buy brand new cars, but I do buy used cars that have that on it, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure if my travels are being recorded and sold to somebody.
You know, I listened to the testimony of your previous hearing, Senator Clausen. I think it was you that talked about going to the doctor's office and not wanting to sign a consent form.
It was Senator Limmer.
And I think that a lot of people simply sign what's put in front of them because they trust the people who are asking for the signature. And whether that signature is an actual pen and ink signature or whether it's a click, if you trust the company you're doing business with, I think we all want to, you know, defer to the honesty of the people that we're doing business with. When it comes to genetic information, however, you know, as quaint and and harmless as talking about where your ancestors came from at Christmas dinner, it has profound implications for what that data means beyond that, just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, if you eat too much candy, you risk getting diabetes. And if you risk looking at this information as kind of like cute candy-coated discussion topics, you do a tremendous disservice, A, to the importance of the data, but also to the urgency of understanding the need for protection, privacy protection.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. Pitts, for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Members, let's move on to before you, we have in your packets just a document that I had House Research helped me put together, just on some recommendations to the full legislature on three different topics, one being this one and one being the issue of the Minnesota Health Records HIPAA issue. And what I'd like to do is take up the third recommendation first. I know Representative Schultz, you weren't here when we took up, when we had Mr. Boosey talk about this issue, but is there any discussion among commission members on that particular provision? Representative Lesh.
I'm sure we've talked about this, but where is use for non-governmental purposes defined?
Right there.
Well,
okay, one second.
It's existing.
Yeah, I know, but where is that defined?
Maybe we can have House Research answer that
sure.
question. Yep. Go ahead, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, use for non-governmental purposes is not defined in that statute.
So, okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh?
What would then, who would decide that then? Would that be an administrative law judge, or would that be a jury, or who decides what it is?
Mr. Hopkins?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, it would depend on what sort of forum an individual that felt that this section was violated chose to address the issue. If they asked for an opinion from the Commissioner of Administration, then the Commissioner of Administration could issue an opinion on that particular question. If they filed a civil lawsuit, it would go before a judge or a jury. And if they filed an administrative action, then an administrative law judge would make that sort of determination.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. And then, Madam Chair, Mr. Hopkins, are the penalties for this the same as any standard penalties in Chapter 13? So it's like $2,000 a pop max or something?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, the penalties for a violation of 13.055 are the same, I believe, as for any other section in Chapter 13. There's no special penalties for violation of this section.
Representative Lesh?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Any other member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this recommendation regarding what Mr. Boosie testified to? Well, hip, hip, hooray. So I'm not sure exactly which protocol we should, what protocol we should use, if we should vote on these one at a time. I'm guessing that's probably the best thing to do. And we still do have a quorum here without Senator Limmer, but I guess we'll go ahead and take a vote. All those in favor of recommendation 3 to the full legislature of striking that portion of line in current law on 13.055, and that would be the language or the words that say of data only occurs, intent to use the data for non-governmental purposes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. That recommendation will be going to the full legislature. The next thing I'd like to take up is the issue of the medical records matter that we heard from what is known as the Representative Zerwas bill and amendment. And I would like to open that up for discussion among members here. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is this consent form, are we voting on this form as well, or is this just an example?
This is just an example. This is just an example of what it could look like. I think we're just voting today on the concept. So, any discussion? I would like to Senator Claussen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I like the idea of one document being in the hands of a consumer to look at. And I also like the idea that there's a little box there to extend any of the consent check yes to 3 years. So I'm assuming that this is in effect for 3 years, and then it has to be reviewed by the consumer.
This is just sample language, mm-hmm. And right now current law says that your consent is only good for 1 year. So that would be an expansion of that. Okay. Again, this is just a sample.
All right.
Mm-hmm. But good, very good question. Representative Schultz.
So was there more in Zerwas' bill, this was just a piece of his bill, or how does this recommendation differ from the content of the Zerwas bill, House File 3312?
My understanding is the original bill was a little bit broader than just the treatment, payment, and operations piece, which was really his amendment, mm-hmm. Is my understanding. And so actually, we may want to amend some of these or this document to say that it would be we could just articulate that this form. Well, I don't even know if that's something that we have to put in the full recommendation, that it was this Zerwas language. But what we would probably just say then is the commission recommends that for treatment, payment, and operations. That this form is used, or really just a patient should have the opportunity to opt in and opt out of these different things. I guess what I also go back to, Representative Schultz, is I've seen so many different consent forms from so many different providers, and no two are the same. And I think having a uniform consent form is going to be helpful to everybody, because then they're all looking at the same consent form. Whether it's Alina and they're shipping information over to Health Partners, they're all looking at the same, working off the same document. So I think there's value in having some uniformity there.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. So just for the record, I think the maybe the order of these questions where they're checking yes or no needs to be evaluated, and maybe some way to either number them, letter them. Okay. And I think some at the very bottom, like releasing medical records, you might want to put more closer to the top. But also this, we're just to be clear, we're not going to the federal HIPAA. We're maintaining our statute on our stronger HIPAA regulations in the state. And wasn't the intent in Zuras's bill to just adopt the federal HIPAA regulations?
It was. The HIPAA or the Zuras amendment was to adopt the HIPAA language for treatment, payment, and operations, just those three. So those are good comments about rearranging and numbering things. I think those are good comments. And again, we're not voting on this form exactly. We're just voting in concept that that there should be a universal consent form.
Madam Chair.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. Would we expand this, let's say, for a dental patient to look at? If you're visiting the chiropractor, in other words, you know, what would be, how far-reaching would this form be? How far-reaching would be our recommendations?
Right. Well, anywhere with you, I think anytime you go in to see one of those providers, you're signing something,
mm-hmm. Right.
Or you've signed it at least once a year. And so this would just replace that. So you sign that when you go to the dentist or the chiropractor at least once per year. And so this would just be kind of replacing whatever you're signing now. Anyone have any other comments? Is there?
I have one more comment.
Sure.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I just want to put this in the record. So when we continue, whoever is on this commission in the future, really look at how we can conform with federal HIPAA, but also think about what the future will hold, and that will be people owning their own data, having their own individual health record. So the patient person will own it and not necessarily the healthcare facility or provider. So I think we should think about how that would affect our current HIPAA statute and how we can make it easy for that to happen, because I personally believe that people should own their own data and be able to share that with providers wherever they go to get care.
Right. I appreciate you saying that. I was, you know, one of the great values of door knocking when you're running for office is you never know who's going to be on the other side of that door. And so I knocked on a door this summer and happened to be my doctor. And I was visiting with her about this issue, and she said, well, it's your data. So she acknowledged that it's your data, so that you should have control over your records. Senator Limmer.
While we're on this discussion, I would agree with Representative Schultz's idea that we should own our own data, but the courts have said otherwise. They've basically said whoever maintains the data is now the owner. And that's where a little rub is when we write future legislation. But the control of the data by the individual mm-hmm. is critical, and that's what this form represents. Instead of relying just on a federal law called HIPAA that the Zuras bill originally wanted to do and then repeal all of Minnesota's Health Record Act, or at least a goodly portion of it, I thought went just a little too far. You know, the Health Record Act in Minnesota, which is a little more protective of individual data, was created over 30 years ago. And we didn't visualize at that time all of the computerized digital transfer of information that now can be speedily transferred from place to place. It's kind of curious that the industry has come up with the Zuras bill when the systems that are requested, that are in this or in play, do not have a common language to talk to one another. That interoperability is not existent right now. And yet they want the change so that they can transfer information in a much more speedily way. It may be in anticipation of a future universal platform that can send signals back and forth. But I believe that Minnesota is going in the right direction. I think we are becoming a model for other states. Other states that have relied purely on HIPAA have begun to rethink their reliance on HIPAA, and they're looking at other states that have put a little bit more protection on the individual. And the individual can now, if they want, and I would visualize that most people just don't care. They want everything out in the open to be transferred easily. I'm assuming that. If that's true, that customer can say yes to the bottom question, and they can have their wishes known. But their wishes are controlled by that individual. And I think that's critical for our state. It's in tradition of Minnesota being highly protective of the individual's autonomy as well as their own personal information and where it goes. The digital world is putting all sorts of challenges on us in across all the fields, just like we saw in the genetic testing area. And I kind of like the idea of having a universal form, because when they do get to that interoperability, the form is uniform as well, and it can transfer even more efficiently from system to system based on the wishes of the individual. So I think this is a good first step in getting a little bit more meat on the bones and going in a direction that not only recognizes where we've been as a state, but it also tips a hat to the federal law as well. I think it's a good step toward a compromise. And I think you raise a good question about who actually owns the property. Well, that's already been decided, and I think the courts were wrong in that, but nevertheless, the control of that information may be the next default step to protect the individual.
And we know the court gets it right 100% of the time, too. Is there anyone in the public wishing to testify for or against these recommendations? Well, all righty then. Members, would you like to take these recommendations A and B, or do you want to adopt them as together? Anybody have a preference either way? If not, then we'll adopt them together. All those in favor of adopting the recommendations for patient consent and disclosure of medical records under the Minnesota Health Records Act and the Commission's recommendations below that, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. That motion is adopted. Members, I do have recommendations on the back related to the privacy and direct-to-consumer genetic testing. And these are mostly based on the research document prepared by Mr. Hopkins during our last hearing. And it talked about some of the things that we would probably need to do to shore up our current statutes. And also some suggestions to look further into the Genetic Privacy Act of Alaska. And then also some of these recommendations were from page 2 of that doc. I think it's page 2 or is it page 3? Page 3 of that document where he, Mr. Hopkins, listed some specific privacy concerns that we might want to look into further. And so this is kind of, there are some recommendations that, yes, for sure we need to make, and some other things are just kind of, let's look further into this issue on this list of recommendations. Was there any discussion in any of these letters A through I? All right. Are you prepared to vote on these today, then? All right. All those in favor of recommendations for the privacy and direct-to-consumer genetic testing issue, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Those are adopted. Members, I believe this is our last meeting for the year, so I appreciate everyone participating on this commission. We had some really good discussions. I appreciate the time commitment that you took to be here, especially those that came from a longer distance away to make it to some of these hearings. Representative Lesh?
Madam Chair, I want to thank you for all the work that you put into this. You've clearly kind of put your heart and soul into a lot of these issues, and that's what's required over a topic area that's as arcane as this. So thank you for doing that. I mean, you definitely did the job of a chair, what a chair is supposed to do, and I for one, appreciate it.
Thank you. Any further discussion for the good of the body? No? If not, then, members, we are adjourned.